Trump now has a much more loyal team. He has a much better experience. But I'm still concerned that he takes everything too personally and that he doesn't like, how to put it, he doesn't like to become too involved in an intellectual thinking and learning about things.
Nobody in Russia yet did clearly explain to new administration what really we want of Ukraine, but we really want the full and total control over Ukraine as the part of our space, as for Canada, for example, for United States.
In the short run, I am not sure that we can get any lasting peace.
We think that without Russia, universe should not exist. That is our belief. And if this belief is supported by red button, so you'd better don't try to see how deep is our belief.
Hello, everyone. This is the New Rules Podcast, and I'm your host, Dmitry Symes Jr. We are continuing our series about the Trump 2.0 presidency from a multipolar perspective. Last time we talked about Trump and Iran. This time we're going to talk about Trump and Russia. And to help me tackle this genuinely enormous topic, I'm very pleased to welcome two distinguished guests. Professor Alexander Dugin, a longtime friend of the program and one of Russia's leading political philosophers and geopolitical figures. And Dmitry K. Symes, the host of Channel One's political talk show, The Big Game. He is one of the few people who personally knows both Putin and Trump. And most importantly, he's my father. So without him, there wouldn't be any New Rules podcast. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
So I have a question that I want to address to both of you, but let me start with you, Dmitry. In 2016, the first time Trump ran, he came on a promise to improve U.S.-Russian relations, but they only ended up getting worse during his term. Now he ran on the promise to end the Ukraine conflict. What does Russia expect from Trump 2.0? And what should Trump expect from Russia in 2024?
Well, let's start with 2016. I think that Trump was sincere when he was promising to improve the relationship. He was also promising to have successful presidency. That did not happen. He was sabotaged from the first moment by some of his own appointees. He did not have a game plan. He was inexperienced in foreign affairs. So as a result, what he wanted to do and what was done were two very different things. And clearly, Russian officials still remember it very well. And President Putin talked about that. Now, of course, he's much more experienced. Now he knows people personally. Actually, he knows well people he is appointing to key positions. So there is a reason to have high expectations. But he also is an undisciplined, impatient person. And with him, you may also anticipate surprises, including unpleasant surprises.
What about the second part of the question? What should Trump expect from Russia? How is the Russia of 2024 different from the Russia of 2016?
Well, it's very different because of the special operation and everything associated with that. As you know, in Moscow, there is a very different narrative than in the United States. In Moscow, the assumption is that there is an unholy crusade launched against Russia by the West, led by the United States. Russia have done a lot to deal with this aggression. Russia is working very hard on contributing to a new world order. And I don't think that Russia would be prepared to sacrifice all the things just to win Trump's favor. So my assumption is that Trump can expect from Russia a positive attitude to any constructive new initiatives. But he should understand that just sweet talk would not do.
What about you, Professor Dugin? Would you say that the expectations for Trump from Russia are different than they were in 2016? And if so, what are the expectations right now?
So I think that during first term of presidency of Trump, he simply had not clear ideas about Russia, about world politics. So that was a kind of test because he wasn't prepared to lead some strategy. He had a very interesting idea about how to concentrate the main efforts on the domestic politics rather than to continue globalist agenda. So he was a bit awkward doing so, but I don't think he failed completely. He tried, he tested, and now he is much more experienced in foreign politics. I agree totally with Mr. Symes Senior that he has appointed wrong persons in his first term presidency, and he suffered from that. Now his attitude to his team is different. Now he's going to make a kind of they call it the bro revolution inside of America to finally end the rule of the swamp of globalists. And this time he's very serious, I think, and On this scene, for him personally, as politician, Russia doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't represent big deal. So for him, it is annoying conflict that wasn't started by him, but by his political opponents. And he would like to stop it, to freeze it, to stop it, to get rid of it somehow. But I think that the problem is he doesn't understand the real importance of the Ukraine for Russia. He misjudges the situation, thinking that is just about some new acquisitions of earths, of territories, and not existential threat neither to Russia nor to the West. So I think that may cause the real problem in his expectations of dealing with Russia, of his evaluation of this balance of power situation. So he couldn't understand that it is not extremist claim, but Russia could not live, could not be anymore without Ukraine. So theoretically, Russia could tolerate neutral Ukraine. But after all that was happened there, existence of Russia is incompatible with existence of any form of Ukraine. And maybe that could seem to Trump a bit exaggerated, but that is very realist approach. So if he could understand that it is not exaggerated claim, but rather existential necessity of Russian geopolitical being, of political being, he could deal with Russia more carefully. But he lacks today as well, he lacks the serious specialists and experts in the foreign politics. Maybe with the exception of Tulsi Gabbard, he is very, very, very far-looking person, and some other people. But I think in any situation, Russia is not his main concern. He is much more concerned, as long as I understand, about Middle East, about support for Israel, maybe his will to deal with fighting with Iran, or just opposing Iran, or freezing the conflicts. But Middle East is of highest priority to him and Russia of second priority. But it could be a bad trick, but a kind of trap for him. He underestimates the importance of Ukraine for Russia. And if he would have correct understanding of it, it could help to us with the relations with new team of president, and for American-Russian relations as well, for them.
Both of you have alluded to the fact that Trump lacks detailed knowledge or understanding of Russia, which makes having a competent and ideologically aligned team all that more effective, which I think makes a logical transition to my next question, because Joseph Stalin famously said that personnel determine everything. And over the past week, we've seen Trump essentially assemble a team of neocons. And admittedly, when it comes to the Ukraine, some of them have shown evolution, some of them have become more skeptical. But indeed, with the exception of Tulsi Gabbard, who was appointed director of national intelligence, all of them more or less have a hawkish position on Ukraine. So my question is, what's been the reaction in Moscow, Dmitry, to the foreign policy team that Trump has assembled?
Well, obviously, Secretary of State, assuming Marco Rubio will be confirmed by the Senate, and I assume he is going to be confirmed. It's fairly non-controversial. He is a former neocon. Now he sounds more like a realist, whether it is sincere or he is trying to placate Trump, we're going to discover pretty soon. New national security advisor, he was a neocon. He also kind of evolved into a hard-nosed realist. But you are right, with an exception of Tulsi Gabbard, there is no person in the new team who would even understand what Professor Dugin spoke about the unique importance of Ukraine for Russia. I don't think there is any one of these people who understands how special is Ukraine to Russia, what is the history of Ukraine. They probably feel that Ukraine was a state which existed for centuries and centuries, and suddenly Russia kind of invaded out of the blue. I do think that second echelon appointments in this case would be very important. For instance, when I look at a position of national security advisor, there were two models. One was Kissinger, a conceptualizer, a person with clear thinking, and this clear thinking was shared by President Nixon. Another model was Brent Scowcroft, who was national security advisor at first for President Ford, and then, of course, for his friend, President George Bush Sr. Scowcroft was a very different person. He was a very skillful organizer and also a person who positioned himself as an honest broker. He ran the National Security Council in a way that all important opinions, particularly opinions of different agencies, would be shared with the president. When I look at the new National Security Advisor, he's a former congressman. When he was in the military, he did not move about the rank of captain. What kind of national security advisor he would be? He's certainly not known as a deep thinker, and he never commanded a major bureaucracy. So it really is going to be a very interesting situation in terms of what these people would be able to do for Trump and what kind of people they are going to hire. For me, I completely agree with Professor Dugin that Trump now has a much more loyal team. He has a much better experience. But I'm still concerned that he takes everything too personally. and that he doesn't like, how to put it, he doesn't like to become too involved in an intellectual thinking and learning about things. So I'm open-minded about what he would be able to accomplish in foreign policy.
Professor Dugin, I'd be interested in getting your reaction to Trump's recent foreign policy picks, because we've talked with you on this program numerous times about American politics, of American right, and potential common ground with Russia. And you've continuously explained that Russia doesn't have a problem with America as such, but they have a problem with the globalist elites running America, the globalist American empire. And you express hope that Trump could sort of be the sort of nationalist revolutionary figure to free America from this globalist stronghold. When you look at Trump's recent picks, do you see them as anti-globalist revolutionaries or career opportunists that won't be able to get the revolutionary job done?
So it is I'm sure that the globalists, they represented two wings, left liberals and neocons. Neocons and left liberals, two way to the same goal, expansion of American hegemony, of imperialism, imposing globalist agenda to all countries and civilizations. And that was dominating politics during previous presidencies. Democrats or Republicans, they had in common this globalist, right globalism, or left globalism, bad globalism. And the main idea of Trump is to resist, it is to protest against any kind of globalism. So he was hated, really hated by left liberals, globalists, and by neocons. So Dmitry has pointed out very important things. This evolution of maybe imposed evolution, maybe not sincere, maybe fake evolution, but evolution from neocons position to the realist position. Because Trump is manifestation of political realism. And that is totally different attitude to the foreign affairs, to international relations as well. So that realism consists in measuring the real and calculation, the real national interests, and how to achieve this racial goal to establish the strong and prosperous and flourishing national state of United States. And that is very, very rational. And if we accept this national realism as dominant position, so we see no real reasons to fight with Russia, to compete with Russia. In present situation, Russia doesn't represent any threat in economy, in politics, except of having nuclear weapon that is necessary to defend our sovereignty. In all the other conflicts, regional conflicts, economical processes, financial sphere, we Russians have nothing to be considered as the threat to the American interests. And realism should be aware. Any normal realist should be aware of it. So, but this realism, the normal realism, not neoconservative, neither liberal globalist, it was absent during last decades of American history. So they belong, the people of such kind as Dmitry has evoked, has mentioned, they belong to the different era. And that is the problem. So the majority, absolute majority of the experts and the people involved in the international relations during the last decades, they were either liberals, globalists, or neoconservatives. So the critical mass of realists in the field of international affair could be, this lack could be fatal, could be very, very dangerous for Trump. He would like to have the team of realists around himself, but maybe there is a kind of shortage of them. I could not foresee how it will end, but he badly need new kind of international strategical thought. Curtis Yarvin, very interesting guy from United States, a typical right anti-globalist. He has recently written precisely about this problem. So Trump needs totally new kind of a specialist, new team. In some fields, for example, Doggy of Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. In the other aspects, Trump tries to find the new type of persons in order to fight against the corruption of Democrats, against ultra-liberal elites. But maybe for the foreign policy, this lack could be very dangerous, and it is obviously he need new international vision based on the thought where and how United States of America with Trump and maybe with continuation of Trumpist attitude, how United States should look like, what is this new strategy outside of globalism. He clearly fights against globalism, but what he tries to replace it, it is not clear, not evident.
So he has a clear understanding of the enemy, so to speak, but he doesn't have a clear idea of what to replace the broken system with.
Exactly, more or less so.
Let me put it this way, though. You say that there is a sort of realist pivot under the Trump administration. Let me ask this way. From Russia's perspective, who's a better or less objectionable interlocutor, Antony Blinken or Marco Rubio?
Oh, it's clear. So Blinken is worst. Biden is worst. Kamala Harris is worst. Obama is worst. Hillary Clinton is worst. So there is no doubt. We should try to speak with Rubio, because I have heard some of his sayings and affirmations. They are not at all hostile to us. So he maybe fantastically had just suggested some kind of coordinated efforts against the other enemies. It was naive, but it was not clearly and radically Russophobic. So I think we should try to find the mutual understanding with these real or fake, but realists. If you start to pretend to be something or someone, you ends to become it. So because society is the game of the roles, of the masks, and that is sociological approach. And if you repeat many times that you are this or that, so finally you become it. So we should not underestimate the declarations, the words, because we are living in the language, and I think the realist language should replace neoconservative language in American right, and that will be a great deal. And we should try to find a way to interpret them. And so I see no chance for us dealing with globalists. They are fanatics. They are very dangerous. And they have proved that they are killers. They are criminals. And we should try to make acquaintance with new type of Americans. And I think that Trump gives us such a chance.
So if we assume that there is some sort of hope for Russia and the United States working out a mutually acceptable solution to the Ukraine conflict, at the moment, we don't have any sort of specifics, right? Trump has come out and promised to end the conflict, but he hasn't explained how he'll end the conflict. The only indication of a plan came out from the Wall Street Journal last week. And basically, the quote-unquote Trump peace plan, as described by the Wall Street Journal, consisted of three main points. First of all, freezing the conflict along the current front lines, creating a demilitarized zone, which for some reason would have European troops deployed along the zone. And three, delaying the question of Ukraine's NATO membership for 20 years. I'll start with you, Dmitry. Would Moscow be willing to seriously consider such an offer?
Well, first of all, as you said, this is a plan from the Wall Street Journal. This is not a plan from future President Trump. I also do not quite like Trump's, somewhat patronizing rhetoric. I will tell Putin, I will tell Zelensky, okay, they should sit down and they should agree with my ideas during 24 hours. I think that before Russian president would sit with anyone, he would want to know what the ideas are, what the proposals are. And you know well that Richard Nixon, he took summits, particularly with adversaries, very seriously. And he always thought that they had to be well prepared. And that at first you have lower ranking people talk to each other and to establish that there is at least some common ground. Now, about Wall Street Journal ideas for Trump. There may be some kind of truth. President Putin made it clear that in principle that may be acceptable to Russia, but the devil is in details. If you are talking about any kind of truth and want Russia to stop military activities, Ukraine has to accept certain minimal conditions. Ukraine so far is not accepting any Russian conditions, ignoring Russian consents, and basically talks about Russian surrender, nothing short of that. So as long as Ukraine is not prepared to accommodate Russian basic consents, then there will be no truce. There may be negotiations about truce. Like in the case of Vietnam, there were long negotiations. And at the same time, there was a lot of fighting. These two things are not incompatible. And I think it should be clearly understood that President Putin said that he would not instruct the Russian army to stop fighting simply because Ukraine would be willing to negotiate, but without seriously acknowledging and in some terms satisfying Russian conditions. The idea of the separation, buffer zone, you know, again, the devil is in details. In the Wall Street Journal, they were talking about British troops being put in that buffer zone, or some other kind of NATO troops. Well, you know, that's not, in this case, a buffer zone. That is a zone where NATO would put its forces on the Russian border. I cannot imagine that Russia would even consider this seriously. And also, the Wall Street Journal was saying, well, it's possible to postpone bringing Ukraine into NATO, But in addition to putting NATO troops on Russian border, we should also start arming Ukraine even more than now. You know, that, in my view, is essentially de facto bringing Ukraine into NATO. I cannot imagine that this would be acceptable to the Russian government.
Professor Dugin, obviously the point about deploying British or European troops would be a non-starter for Russia. I don't know how anyone in Washington could take such a proposal seriously. But it's clear that even aside from the people quoted in the Wall Street Journal, you see a lot of people in American Republican circles, Trump-aligned circles, basically saying that the way the peace is freezing the current front lines, delaying the issue of NATO membership for Ukraine, and continuing to supply Ukraine with weaponry as sort of an alternative to NATO membership. Are any of those 3 points acceptable for Russia, or are they also non-starters?
That is absolutely clear. That's known. Of these conditions is acceptable for Mr. Putin or for Russia in nothing. So it is absolutely unrealistic. We speak about the freezing of the conflict after we have guarantees that all territory of Ukraine will be under control, as a matter of fact. From this point, we start our deal, our talks. Before, it is absolutely unacceptable, neither freezing the conflict on the line of contact, not to speak about putting there some European Western troops that are considered to be the part of the conflicts by us. We, in our opinion, the West is fighting against us. They had no reason, no normal logical basis to put more troops there. So we don't believe anymore to the West about saying, oh, Ukraine will never be in NATO, because it is a lie. And so the only way to us to start the peace talk is to get the full control over all territory of Ukraine. Putting in the cart the Nazi chiefs of Kyiv's regime, and after that, we start the talks how we could deal with the West. Everything else is negotiable. We could negotiate about everything else, but not about our full control of total territory of Ukraine. But you would say, but what Russia could propose? Clearly, we could propose, if these conditions are rejected immediately, so we could propose not to good things, but bad things. We could arm Islamic Pole forming now against Israel, and that will lead sooner or later to destruction, total destruction of Israel. We don't like that, We are very rational in that sense. But for Trump, Israel, Middle East is of highest priority, much more than Ukraine. So we could make cause pain to the West, to Trump, or we could stay more or less neutral as Israel or Islamic states are regarding our war in Ukraine. So we have many other global issues. Ukraine is not the only thing that is between us, between Russia and the West. There are many other issues, and in these issues we could behave ourselves much more aggressively than we did before. So that is deal. That is about business. So if you are realist, you should be rationally, you should rationally calculate what I get, what is my gain, what could I gain if Russia will start nuclear conflicts and will destroy humanity in response to our position, extremist globalist position in Ukraine. That if I gain something, that the costs will be too high. So that is realistic, rational calculation of situation. But that point is crucial. Nobody in Russia did clearly explain to new administration what really we want of Ukraine, but we really want the full and total control over Ukraine as the part of our space, as for Canada, for example, for United States or
Mexico.
So
I think that's an important clarification. When you say full control, that doesn't necessarily mean that Russian troops march all the way through the Polish border, you know, raise the Russian tricolor over Lvov and Ivano-Frankivsk.
Why not?
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just trying to clarify.
There are many things to get a full control of the territory with military expansion, military occupation, or without. There are, in modern world, there are many means to achieve the goal by soft power, by hard power, by political control, social control, economical control. So I think that is the starting point of our real negotiations with Trump. And the sooner he knows that, the better he will be prepared for that. So we may be dealing with Biden's administration that was totally hostile. We didn't know explain to them what we really wanted. So, but I think we should behave ourselves sincerely now, dealing with the new administration that is not a priori Russophobic or hostile to us. So we need to be clear and frank. And I think that to put it fairly, so we need full control over Ukraine. And that is starting point of our talks. If it will be known and understood by new administration that will the good injection of political realism. We could explain why, or maybe we shouldn't explain. That is secondary. But for us, Ukraine is essential, existential, ontological priority. Everything else we could negotiate about, not about Ukraine.
So, Dmitry, I obviously have to ask you about this as well. Let's assume that Trump is genuinely serious about wanting to get a Ukraine peace deal with Russia. What are Russia's conditions for peace? And do you agree with Professor Dugin that the conflict will continue until either Russia or Ukraine is totally defeated?
Well, I think in the long run, probably. In the short run, I am not sure that we can get any lasting peace. We were talking about some armistice agreement, something considerably more modest and temporary. But can I talk a little bit about history?
Of course.
When Russia accepted the independence of Ukraine, and I think it was a big mistake, but what was done cannot be easily undone. But when Russia accepted the independence of Ukraine, the Ukrainian population was divided almost equally into two parts, Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers. And there was a demographic and political balance in Ukraine. That was acceptable to Russia. That proved to be unacceptable to the United States and other NATO countries. And they began destabilizing Ukraine step by step. In 2014, it was a militant coup d'etat in Kyiv, which was arranged by the West. It was not arranged by Russia. And a legitimate government was overthrown. under those circumstances to protect the population of Crimea, the vast majority of this population were Russian speakers and clearly wanted to be with Russia, Russia decided to take over Crimea. Then there were Minsk agreements, where President Putin made clear that he was willing to keep Donbass inside Ukraine, provided these provinces would have considerable autonomy and their citizens would be able to affect Ukrainian foreign policy. Russia has agreed to something that was, I would say, a very major concession. That also proved to be unacceptable. We also have learned in a very hard way that Minsk agreements never meant to the West what they meant to Russia. As a result, there was special military operation. I'm asking a simple question. How could Russia accept Ukraine in its current borders? That would be inherently hostile Ukraine. There would be absolutely no chance to have any friendly Ukrainian government. Accordingly, even as a transitional step, Russia needs to be sure that Ukraine would not have, as Alexander said, a government influenced or even dominated by the Nazis. There would have to be some kind of agreement of a real political reform in Ukraine, which would guarantee that there would be no government hostile to Russia. I don't know how Russia can accept anything less. I don't know what you think.
I agree, absolutely. That is the problem. So that is not about our greed to have additional territories. It is the reason of our to be or not to be, of our existence. If we have hostile governments, Russophobic, aggressing this part of population and our own territory, as in Kursk, so we could not feel ourselves safe. We have no security, and we are already in the war. And now there is no reason at all to stop it in middle way. So we are obliged to continue beyond all the costs could be acceptable, because the only way to secure, to grant to us the real safety in the future, in long term, in long run. So I think it is precisely totally different Ukraine. And you could not be sure is it different or not without concrete participation in creating it, in installing this government. So without control, we could not believe the West. We could not believe present Nazi regime. So we need to be sure that everything is under control. Otherwise, we will be under continuous eternal threat, existential threat from hostile and aggressive and absolutely unhuman power that will eternal menace to us.
Yeah. So would it be fair to say that Russia's bare minimum is that no more Zelensky, current Ukrainian elite has to go, and Ukraine has to accept both that Crimea has reunited with Russia and that the four territories that voted in 2022, Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson, Zaporozhye, that these five territories are part of Russia and will forever be part of Russia?
So it's too small. So I think if we started to liberate eastern Ukraine, we should finish at least it. So Odessa territory, Kharkov, Dnepropetrovsk, Nikolaev, these four territory more should as well be recognized as part of the Russian Federation. Maybe better than that, we will remake a kind of Eastern Slavic supranational state with Belarus, Belarusia, and all the territory of Ukraine inside of new Eastern Slavic pan-state or supranational state that existed as Russian Empire, Soviet Union, and that was precisely our normal political construction with all three branches of Russians, of White Russians, Small Russians, and Great Russians united in one and the same political entity, in civilizational state, with huge amount of sovereignty and autonomy for all of them as republics, as, for example, the members of United Eurasian States, something like that. So I think that is not about to turn apart Ukraine and to have control over some territories. We need whole Ukraine, not necessarily inside of Russia, but not outside of Russia.
Yeah, I mean, I think that our viewers by now have realized how hard this sort of potential Ukraine deal would be, because you have the Trump people hoping to make tactical concessions and being able to, you know, put this under the rug, put it away and move on to other things. And you have, as both of you pointed out, Russia saying that this is an existential strategic matter and there need to be big fundamental changes being made. I can only imagine how difficult it would be for Trump to go to Congress and say, listen, I have to make such a radical deal, or him going to the media and saying that he has to get such a radical deal. And I think our viewers can understand that as well. But I think that even beyond getting a deal, I think an even more pressing question is, can we avoid World War III? Because some Republicans are calling for negotiations with Russia, while others are calling for escalation. In particular, for example, Trump's incoming national security, Mike Waltz, who you alluded to earlier. Just one day before the election, he called on the U.S. to not only ramp up sanctions against Russia, but to authorize Ukraine to use American long-range missiles for strikes deep into Russian territory. And there are a lot of congressional Republicans who want President Trump to go that extra step. If Trump decides to listen to their advice, if he decides to fold under their pressure, what sort of response can he expect from Russia?
Well, let me start that there is a danger that before Trump becomes president, that Biden may authorize something like that. And that really would be a very tough situation for Russia, because it would be a huge provocation. But you don't want to be provoked by an outgoing administration, because you want at least to have a window of opportunity with the new Trump administration. But obviously, whatever happens in this regard, Biden is not going to last for more than 2 months. And I'm sure that during this period, the Russian government, if the West comes to the West, could find responses limited to the Ukrainian territory. If something like that would become a new American policy after Trump is in the White House, I think that Russia would have to respond very harshly. There is an illusion in Washington and other NATO capitals that there is a red line for Russia called NATO Charter, where they have Article 5, which says that if any NATO country is attacked, all countries would come to its defense. But there is no specific language of what other countries are expected to do beyond having consultations. And it's very difficult for me to imagine. Actually, I have to say it's next to impossible for me to imagine any U.S. president would go full scale against Russia, because Russia would attack Baltic states or even Poland, attack in response to their activities against Russia, to their becoming parties, direct participants in the Ukrainian conflict. I think that it would be very important if we come to this situation to have, what I would say, a straight talk with the new American administration, not to threaten without bravado, like they sometimes like to do in the United States, but to say to them very calmly, but also very clearly, that this would be a kind of escalation which would make any country which allows its weapons to be used deep into Russian territory, that country would become an enemy of Russia, and Russia would not be just entitled, but would have no choice but to respond against those countries, whether it would be against their territory, against their bases somewhere else, against the ships. That would something to be determined by the commander-in-chief. But I think that there would have to be a very, very tough response. And I think we have to be very clear about that. We obviously do have Russian officials who know how to talk tough, again, without bravado and exaggeration, and to explain, even to President Trump himself, that he should not play with fire.
Let me play devil's advocate, because Mike Waltz, in that very same interview that I referenced, insisted that Russia is a gas station with nuclear weapons. And I read another interview by Robert Wilkie, who served as Trump's Veteran Affairs Secretary, and he's currently managing the transition process at the Pentagon. And he said that the Russian army has been completely decimated in Ukraine and Russia has nothing except nuclear weapons left, and Russia's too scared to use these nuclear weapons.
Do you remember many years ago when you were younger, we had on occasion coming to our house my colleague Fritz Ermers?
Yeah.
He was my colleague at the Center for the National Interest, but before that he was chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. These are people who brief the president. Under some presidents, it was on a daily basis. Under Trump, it was usually once a week. That council was now moved from the CIA to the National Intelligence. So they are now going to be under Tulsi
Gabbard.
Tulsi Gabbard, exactly. So the question is, what kind of people is she going to hire to work on this council? This is going to be very important, because these people could provide the president with a better perspective on Russian intentions, on Russian capabilities, on Russian political mindset. That obviously will not solve Russian problem with the United States. But I think it would be a useful step in order to avoid ignorant people doing ignorant and dangerous things.
Professor Dugin, I want to ask a similar question of you, right? Because there is this sort of widespread perception in Western political circles that Russia has been exposed as a paper tiger, as a colossus on glass clay feet, and that if the West pressures Russia, they won't have any serious consequences. How would you expect Russia to respond if Trump does listen to the neocons and decides to escalate the conflict, proxy war against Russia?
So, first of all, I think that we are stronger than we look like, than we look like in Ukraine conflict. First, because we lacked for many years the real experience of war, and now we are just beginning to have to reorganize our army, our society, our troops, our economy, our political system, to adapt it to the condition and the challenges of war. So we are in the this process has already began. You cannot be sure you win the war before you start. So nobody could be totally granted for victory before you try. So that is very, very serious existential field, the war. And I think that Russian army and Russia as a country now is much more ready for real war with the West as 3 years ago. Second, I think that always we have nuclear weapon in the quantity and quality enough to destroy United States of America, to erase totally population of Western Europe. In the response, we will be as well annihilated. But as when we hear our president, Mr. Putin, he has said, if there will be the world without Russia, there will be no such world. So without Russia, no humanity. And that was said not by some radical personality, by a possessor of nuclear weapon and the red button. So that is a kind of our belief, deep belief, and absolute necessity, ontological necessity of our people, of our state, for the history, for the universe. So we think that without Russia, universe should not exist. That is our belief. And if this belief is supported by red button, so you'd better don't try to see how deep is our belief, because it could happen to be a much deeper than you presume. So that is about the real understanding of who we are. We are mystery for the Western mind. We are a very special civilization, very special society, very special people with very special beliefs. And we proved that during many campaigns. We seemed to be weak, we seemed to be without any possibility to respond, and we proved more and more and more how strong and how powerful we are inside, in spite of what we look like. So my main idea is not try to prove will be push the button or not. We can. We have the button. We have nuclear weapon. We have said this openly and clearly by the mouth of our president that will be not tolerate our defeat. So the country with nuclear weapon could not be defeated. And that was said clearly and openly. So you could say, let's test it, how decisive these Russians are. That is the worst solution, I think. Including Biden being old and stupid and close to the dementia, finally he didn't start the nuclear war. He is and was. Sage and wise enough to avoid the wars. And I think that Trump is much more smarter and much more rational, and he has much less arguments and reasons to provoke us in order to know, will we push the button or we will not. It is too dangerous. It is a Russian roulette, a Russian suicide casino, how it is called in English.
So Russian roulette, yeah.
Yes, something like that. So you could be safe or you could be dead. So the idea not to try to know, not to provoke us, because it is not just our ambition or pretensions that we have a nuclear weapon. We have as well iron will of our president and our special deep belief in impossibility of existence of the world without us. That's a point. I think that is it is hard, it is harsh. It is violent, but it is so.
You know, we always end the show on a very pessimistic note. I don't ever remember ending, you know, a conversation with the idea that everything's going to be fine, that our viewers shouldn't worry, and that things will somehow come together. But I think that's part of the reason why all of you continue tuning into the New Rules podcast, because we don't give you the rosy, optimistic take on geopolitics. We tell you about the dangers that exist, and we're openly transparent about the fact that this decade will be one of turbulence, one of chaos, and potentially one of enormous violence and economic instability. Thank you to both of my guests for coming, for giving us such a detailed, candid take. Thank you all for watching. If you like this video, please like it and repost it. And if you enjoyed this video and you want to keep up with our content, please follow us on X. Thank you all for tuning in. Till next time.